All right, my next guest is the one and only Dave Nottig, Chief Investment Officer and Director of Research at ETF Trends and ETF Database. Dave is now on the line with me from Massachusetts. Dave, always great having you on the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me. Do we have anything to talk about? I mean, nothing's going on in the market.
Here's what we're going to do. We're going to cut right to the chase. This is very timely. What happens with ARK Invest? Because as I know you're well aware, I mean, look, their ETFs, we all know the story. They've grown from about $3 billion to, nearly $60 billion in the span of a year. So how does this all end? Happy ending, or does it end in tears, as all the perma-bears like to say, who we're seeing victory laps from right now?
Yeah, I think people are maybe dancing on Cathy Wood's grave a little bit early. So, yeah, I mean, as we're recording this, we have a down day in Tesla. It's down 7% or something like that as I'm speaking, which is about what ARKK is down as well. So it means that, you know, they've managed to give up a whole 3.5 weeks of trading profits. Oh, my gosh, it's the end of the world. Like, come on. I don't think anybody is surprised to see a little air come out of some of the, you know, the darlings that everybody was liking. We've got Powell speaking. We have all these externalities. And so, of course, we're going to have an occasional pullback. I am not somebody who thinks that we should be running for the hills. Hey, if you were looking to get into an ARK fund, maybe now's your chance, you know?
Well, let me ask you this. I've talked about the ARK flywheel. So the way I'll lay this out, they've had this unbelievable performance. That's led to huge inflows into their ETFs, which those inflows have then helped drive up the prices of the underlying securities, right? Just because some of those are smaller cap companies. That helps ARK's performance, which leads to more inflows, and around we go. Can that work in reverse?
Yeah, of course, right? So, I mean, asset management is inherently pro-cyclical when you start bundling things, right? A word that you know we're all now using every 5 minutes in every conversation, right? If you put a bunch of money into a fund and that fund then goes and buys a bunch of small cap stocks and then those small cap stocks go up and the performance of the fund goes up, then people will want to buy more because people chase performance, right? There's nothing magical here. This isn't some, you know, newly developed branch of behavioral finance we need to go grab Dan Egan and do the math on. Like, this has been the way investors have behaved since time immemorial. When we get into particularly frothy markets, when we throw a lot of cash into the system, both of which is where we're at, then, yeah, you're going to end up in these periods where it's a little tough to figure out valuations. It's a little tough to figure out which way things are going. But I think that, you know, crying the demise of a particular manager because we have one down day in the market seems a little silly.
What about capacity constraints? So let's say these past couple of days, it's just a blip, right? And the market continues to sort of grind higher. ARK continues to take in massive amounts of money, which they have this year. How big of a concern is just capacity, their ability to handle the money coming in? And does it impact performance?
It certainly doesn't impact their ability to play in Tesla stock because Tesla is now in the S&P 500. And it certainly doesn't hurt their ability to, you know, make their calls in companies like NVIDIA and Apple, where they've been really quite open about their love for those types of companies. I think where it really hurts them more is in some of the narrower parts of the market where, you know, I think we always talk about Cathie Wood because she's sort of the name above the title for the firm. Her analyst team is really rock solid. And if you get down to some of the smaller names that aren't, you know, name above the title, some of the genomic stocks and things like ARKG, some of the sort of more afield blockchain plays they've got, some of them are quite small cap, right? They're, you know, $100 million companies, $200 million companies, which sounds like a lot of money, but in security space, that's tiny, tiny, tiny. They're not going to be able to make meaningful investments in companies like that as multi-billion dollar funds. That's just true. Sure, they'll make those investments, but I highlighted the other day a trade that they made, which was, you know, a fairly substantial position. It was like, you know, a few percent of a company that they were unloading from the company's perspective. It literally wasn't a fourth decimal exposure move for the fund, right? Meaning that it was 0.00001% of ARKK, right? So obviously meaningless from an investment exposure perspective. They no longer get to play in those stocks. They'll still buy them, but as an investor, you're not making plays in those stocks.
In terms of ARK's overall business, I was visiting with ETF.com Cynthia Murphy earlier, and we were talking about ARK's upcoming space ETF launch. Do you expect to see more ETF offerings from ARK, maybe as a way to try and diversify their business, just open up a little more capacity from investors overall?
Oh, for sure. Like, if I was the chief strategy officer there, I'd have a list of 25 products lined up. I would also think about retooling a little bit. I think a lot of people look at ARKK as their best ideas fund, which certainly it has been, right? I mean, you could sort of go across the other products in the lineup and see the top holdings from those other funds show up in ARKK. I think it's reasonable for them to think about expanding that to be not a 30, 40, 50 stock portfolio, but more of like an 80, 90 stock portfolio where you're actually getting all of the best ideas from these other narrower sort of theme-specific products. I would be shocked if we don't see another 4 or 5 new ideas come out from them this year, and I wouldn't be shocked if it was 15 or 20.
All right, let's move on because I want to talk about the GameStop drama, which unfolded recently. And by the way, I thought the congressional hearing last week was absolutely ridiculous. I first asked, like, why is Keith Gill there but not somebody representing the DTCC, right? It just seemed like grandstanding. But look, I want to focus on this piece you wrote titled Welcome to the Thunderdome, an imperfect theory of what's going on. I highly recommend everyone check this out. It's at ETFtrends.com. And the point of the piece was you were attempting to suss out what was going on with GameStop stock at the time. And I think there are several directions we can head here. I guess let's start with this narrative that retail investors aren't that smart. Because in the piece you wrote, you actually made the point that some of these people posting on Reddit, they're actually quite well-versed on the markets. And I would say if you watched the congressional hearings last week, you saw a little bit of that with Keith Gill. Right? I mean, this guy's a CFA. I thought he presented pretty darn well. Can you just talk more about this narrative about that retail investors aren't smart?
Every time individual investors show up in the market, they get called dumb money. And that's because in a true bubble with massive masses of crowds showing up, it's really hard not to draw that connection to, you know, the madness of crowds and the tulip bubble and all that jazz, right? And certainly nobody thought that, you know, buying tulips for, you know, a today price of $10,000 was a brilliant idea. However, you know, I think people have to separate the difference between gambling and investing. And they always, since the dawn of time, have gotten mashed up over and over again. Just look at what's going on in Top Shot, right? That's just where this money moved from GameStop, right? It moved from one form of gambling, i.e., I'm going to take a couple $100 and take a flyer, to another form of gambling, which is much more legitimately what we think of as gambling, right? It's the loot box model that's taken over video gaming, where everybody gets to throw $10 in, and maybe you luck out and you pull $200,000 out of the pack. That's a lottery ticket. Let's just acknowledge what that is. The collectability of it means that maybe it's also an investment. But when we look at things like the stock market, we start from that perspective of saying, oh, it's an investment, but maybe also it's a gambling vehicle and a collectible, which is, I think, what people are thinking about GameStop as, or whatever the meme stock of the day is. So there's a lot of different things going on here. It's definitely the case that we have a class of new entrants to the market who are seeing the market as a little bit more of a casino. But I think it's a big mistake to think that's what's driving the market. That's just a narrative that's very nice for the Wall Street Journal to write about.
I have to tell you, I completely fell down the NBA Top Shot rabbit hole, and I'm still stuck there. I've been absolutely just captivated by the platform. I want to do a full podcast on it, see if I can get like the CEO of NBA Top Shot. It's just it's an amazing thing. It's like Robin Hood meets crypto meets trading cards, all mashed together. But look, let's continue kind of on this similar thread, because NBA Top Shot, that's NFTs, non-fungible tokens. There's a crypto tie in there. And in the piece you wrote, you did talk a lot about this crossover between Reddit or Robinhood traders and crypto traders. And I your point, at least in the way I took it, was that crypto has really been the perfect training ground for retail investors. Also, clearly a good source of capital, right, with some of the gains made there. Can you just talk more about that? Because I think I completely agree with sort of this path you're heading down.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would say it's been a good training ground. It has been a training ground for a class of investor. Look, folks who got in early in crypto have several things in common. They tend to be technophiles. They tend to be people who are sort of tapped into the meme economy. And by that, I mean they're already participating in one of several forms of sort of internet community building, whether that's being active on Twitter or being an active Reddit poster or, being a TikToker who's, deep down that well. You're part of some sort of, mechanism for talking to a community about what you're doing. That's been part and parcel of crypto really for the last decade. And then you add in the dynamics of being a crypto investor or, more importantly, a crypto trader. And what we did was we took a whole generation of very smart, tech-savvy folks. We introduced them to this idea of trading. And that idea of trading was heavily unregulated, full of margin, like unbelievable amounts of leverage compared to what most people are considering normal now. And access to really vibrant derivatives and risk markets. That's not something individual investors usually think of when they go open their Schwab account, right? Most people open their Schwab account and they wade into a few mutual funds. Maybe they buy a stock or two, but they're not immediately going after 100 times leverage on their portfolio, which incidentally you can get quite easily trading crypto. That's not a difficult thing to do at all. And now you'll get margin called out of existence very quickly, but those venues exist and are quite alive in the crypto space. So now all those folks show up with a bunch of notional capital that they've sold out because Bitcoin was, at a ridiculous high of 25,000, however long ago it was before it hit 50. And they move that capital over to the security notional economy, and they play by the same rules. They looked for leverage, they looked for derivatives, they looked for opportunities to take a flyer. And frankly, the markets just weren't expecting it.
So I guess if I were to summarize that, I mean, do you feel like crypto, has that skewed the risk tolerances of investors?
Yeah, I think it has. There's this sense of house money that I think is really important, too, that I think those of us who live in the security notional part of the economy don't think about our embedded gains as house money. I think we've learned not to do that. We've learned about position sizing and, taking some off the top when you have really outsized moves. And there's a whole theory of behavioral finance around position management for traders and investors, rebalancing. People write whole academic articles on, well, should you rebalance quarterly or monthly, right? These big, complicated mathematical discussions about how to manage around the edges of portfolio exposure. That's pretty alien to somebody who's coming at this from the crypto space, right? They're thinking, I've talked to many, many crypto investors who've done very, very well and are now sitting on multimillion-dollar accounts. And one thing they will tell you is that the whole time they really started thinking about it as house money until they started taking some off the table and putting it in cash. Then it becomes real money. But TopShot, I think, is a classic example of this, because what TopShot does is it makes you take real money and put it into virtual money in their DApp currency, their distributed application currency pool. And then once it's there, it's actually quite difficult to get out, right? There's a multi-week, I think it's actually 6 to 8 week process to turn that back into cash in your account. So if you open a bunch of packs and you get lucky and you've got $10,000, that feels like house money. And that's just really not the way traditional investors think about it.
Dave, as we kind of talk through all this, I think this all leads down the path of this concept of pro-cyclicality, where everything sort of feeds the beast, right? We can talk crypto, but social media, you mentioned the meme economy, options hedging, stocks being added to indexes, short squeezes. And I felt like in your piece, the main takeaway was around this concept of pro-cyclicality driving at least pockets of the market right now. Can you just expand on that? Like what that means?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's important to recognize that the nature of modern capitalism is it's itself pro-cyclical. And what do I mean by that? There's actually a really phenomenal podcast from the guys at Resolve Asset Management. Gestalt U is the Twitter account for Adam Butler. He just did a great podcast talking about this kind of pro-cyclicality in capitalism itself. And what I mean by that is that winners win, right? So if you have three businesses that are equally situated and one by random chance happens to be successful and one happens to fail, the randomly successful one gets to buy the failure and then get larger, and that firm in the middle gets a smaller and smaller and smaller piece of the pie. It's a self-reinforcing mechanism. That's how you end up with a billionaire class. That's how you end up with wealth inequality, right? All of these things are actually kind of baked into what Adam calls the operating system of capitalism. And that's sort of the rule set that we've set we're going to play by. Then we built all of these money-moving structures around it that are also pro-cyclical, whether it's something as simple as the gamma in options, meaning that if you're an options dealer and you're selling somebody a call and the price of the thing that you're selling the call on goes up, you have to then also be a buyer. That's a pro-cyclical feature, which means that ramps tend to run longer. Leveraged and inverse funds that are rebalancing every day, or just even daily settled swaps, even if they're not packaged up in an ETF, they all have pro-cyclical qualities, right? That daily rebalance means you're always buying into the movement to cover your bets. And so you put all these things together, the foundation of the capital economy, the way we've actually structured the way securities and derivatives work, and then you layer on what has become the pro-cyclical nature of communications, which is another way of saying we all live in our bubble and that bubble gets more intense, which I think feels pretty true to everybody. The whole world is now effectively moving in these pro-cyclical ways, which force us into these cycles of ever bigger booms and busts. And those booms and busts aren't just economic. They're political. They're personal. They're emotional.
I know you're not big into market predictions, but given everything that you just described there, are you comfortable sharing any personal thoughts on the markets right now? And as always, not investment advice. I'd just be curious to hear where your head's at. Like, is any of this keeping you up at night?
No, because yes and no. The reason it keeps me up at night is because I think we have a societal problem, which is very difficult to solve, and I'm not smart enough to figure out how to solve it. Meaning, again, to steal from Adam Butler's way of thinking about it, the operating system itself is what actually needs to be changed, and that's really darn hard, right? That's huge legislative changes. It's rethinking the role of central banks. I mean, it's a big rethink about how capitalism works. I'm not Pollyanna enough to believe that that's going to happen in this or, frankly, the next couple of administrations. I think it's too big a lift, and I don't think there's the political will for it. So that means we've got we're with the partner we brought to the dance. This is the world that we live in. And in that case, what it means to me is it's not about directionality, right? I can't tell. I have no idea whether the market's going to be up or down over the next 12 calendar months. I can paint you a case for up or down 20%. I can paint you a case for up and down 50%, and I can paint you a case for dead flat. What I can tell you is that the likelihood of the tails is much higher than it was, say, 15 years ago. So if you think about the distribution of potential outcomes, we know it's not normalized. Security distributions are never really normalized. We know that they have fat tails. What's happened is those tails are getting fatter and fatter and fatter. Leptokurtosis, as it were, is really difficult to manage as an investor because that's not what our core belief about how the capital market system is supposed to work. Right? CAPM doesn't lead you there. What it leads you towards is convexity, right? Which means that you need to be thinking about how you profit from both ends of the tails. When things go up a lot or when things go down a lot, that's kind of where you want to be making your bet. Now, there are products that do that. There are approaches that do that. You can use options for that. You can simply trade your portfolio to try to be catching which side of the tail you think you're at by looking at implied volatility. There are lots of ways to change how you manage your portfolio, but the core 60-40 diversified portfolio is mostly a victim in a convex market.
Going back to the Reddit traders and, again, this concept of pro-cyclicality, is there any potential ETF impact here? So obviously, you look at like the silver ETF, SLV, that came into the picture a little bit. Cannabis ETFs were targeted. Last week, it was the ProShares UltraVIX short-term futures ETF, UVXY, that had a big inflow. Just from an ETF perspective, obviously, this is an ETF podcast. Does any of this matter or not really, because ETFs can always create and redeem shares?
It matters for one reason, right? So the way to think about what happened with GameStop is not the specific event. I don't care about GameStop. I don't really care about Reddit. What it was a capital attack, right? It was a pool of capital used to attack, and that's the right way of thinking about it, right? A set of resources was brought to bear on a target. It was attacked. And the intent was to crack something in the system, which they did, right? They cracked the short squeeze. Those types of capital attacks, the vulnerabilities for them exist all over the markets. This was one. Silver got targeted because there are people who believe there's a real issue in terms of futures market delivery and warehouse settlement, which because silver is physically settled on the futures markets, which creates really weird and interesting dynamics. And so I think there was this narrative that the capital attack was going to just migrate to silver. Now, it's too early. There is no silver settlement in February. It settles in March. So it doesn't really work. But I think it's reasonable to be concerned about these capital attacks because they're not now coordinated by the Hunt brothers trying to corner the market in commodities. They're now coordinated by effectively a mob, which is influenced by meme dynamics. And that's real darn hard to prepare for. So what it means to me from an ETF perspective is the questions we should be asking are these products structurally sound? Are they participating in markets that are susceptible to capital attacks? And how would they respond if they become the victim of a capital attack? So the place I would worry most, for instance, would be VIX futures. The VIX futures market is surprisingly thin, given how big you think it is. It's, I think, quite manipulatable in the sense that if you took $15 or $20 billion and decided to mess with it, it's fairly easy to mess with. And while $15 billion may sound either like a lot or not very much money, that's roughly the amount that was embedded in the GameStop attack. So it seems reasonable to me that we could have problems in places like that.
Dave, just a couple of minutes left. Two other topics I want to briefly touch on. First, just quickly, what's been your take on ETF flows this year? So I believe around $130 billion has come into ETFs at this point. We're pacing for somewhere in the neighborhood of $900 billion for the year?
Yeah, big number.
It is. Do you think that can hold?
I do. I think so, because what we're seeing is a lot of rout in the mutual fund space. That's not super surprising. Honestly, a little bit of volatility like we're seeing today, as I'm looking right now, you know, we've got some of the meme stocks are down 6 or 7%. You know, VIX has spiked back up. Those things tend to be great for ETFs because they tend to shake people out of bad positions, whether that's, you know, you went super long Tesla at the top or you just bought ARKK at the top and now you're thinking maybe you should reallocate into some core beta. That's really what we've seen. About $20 billion in the flows this year has just been into U.S. large cap. Nothing super fancy, right? It's not all going into ARKK. It's VOO, IVV, RSP. Those are the three largest pulling funds in the large cap equity space so far this year. That's not crazy, right? VOO, IVV, and RSP, three different ways to skin the S&P 500. And then you go further down that list, it's like super broad, boring investment grade bonds, global total markets, emerging markets, total markets. Those are pretty straightforward allocations. So despite all the, you know, the fluff we're seeing in the markets, investors are actually putting their money in some pretty straightforward places.
Okay, lastly, you know that no ETF Prime appearance is complete without me asking you about a Bitcoin ETF. I'm sorry, man.
I can't help myself.
All right, but look, we actually did have two Bitcoin ETFs that began trading in Canada last week. Mm-hmm. You look at the early numbers, pretty impressive. The first ETF is already
$400 trillion or something, like out of the gate. No, it's like $400 million out of the gate.
I think so. Yeah, I think it's already over $500 million in total assets, that first one, BTCC. Now here in the US, I believe there are currently what, three Bitcoin ETF filings? It might be four, but
I don't know. What day is it? I mean, it changes every day.
Well, here's what I'll ask you. Are you any more optimistic about a Bitcoin ETF?
I'm very optimistic now because, you know, I've been following this pattern, frankly, for my entire career of the Ontario Securities Commission leading the SEC by the, you know, nose with a ring towards innovation. They've done that on ETFs. They've done that on every new interesting version of ETFs, whether it was bond ETFs or options-based ETFs. They've been way ahead of literally everything the United States has done. My prediction for how long the pain cycle lasts has been about 6 months. I've been saying that for a couple of years, Nate. You know that. Like, when Canada goes, we tend to fall about 6 months later. Based on that, I now have a date, right? It was February 18th was the day that Canada approved the first real Bitcoin ETF. So August 18th is the day we should get it approved here in the U.S.
One question I have, and I believe this came up in a Clubhouse chat you and I were on a few weeks ago. So I don't think there's any question more ETF issuers will throw their hats in the ring. Like, if I were guessing, I think Bitwise may jump back in with a filing. Maybe the Winklevoss twins circle back around. Granite shares. The question I have is, how will the SEC go about approving these? So like, who do you approve first? Because, as you know, first mover is a huge advantage in the ETF space. And we see it in Canada.
Yeah. And this one's going to be even worse, right? I mean, and this is one of the so the short answer is, of course, I have no idea how they're actually going to do it. The one of the problems is that we don't actually have the kind of parity we've seen in some other approvals. So the non-transparent active stuff, which is probably the most recent sort of big shift, right? The approval of the NTA stuff last year. Those all got pretty similar, right? Presidian was slightly different, but the fundamentals of the kinds of information you needed to give the market, the SEC had a lot of back and forth where they said, like, we need to see it look like this, and then everybody modified their filings to get close, and then they basically kind of approved everybody at once. But importantly, I don't think there was a huge demand spike in the wings, right? Nobody was sitting here with billions of dollars waiting to get into, you know, the T. Rowe Price Blue Chip Growth Fund, no matter how great that fund is. I just don't think we had that kind of bubble behind it. Here, to your point, Nate, boy, this could go real fast. And if, you know, Bitwise got approved first and then VanEck got approved 3 weeks later, you know, VanEck might as well not even enter the race, or vice versa, because I think we'll see such an enormous swarming on the first entry. So I suppose theoretically they could do a note back out to everybody saying, make your fund look like this, wait for everybody to refile, then approve them all on the same day, and then it's sort of made the person with the best capital markets desk and marketing team win. I guess that would be the fairest way to do it.
How much fun would that be to see that happen? You have, I don't know, you know, 5 to 10 Bitcoin ETFs all launch on the same day, and, you know, the best person wins. I just can't even imagine what that would look like. It'd be a complete media frenzy. Dave, I'm going to have to leave it there. I always enjoy having you on the podcast. Really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That was Dave Nodig, Chief Investment Officer and Director of Research at ETF Trends and ETF Database.